From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Mutants and mystics and dysfunctional superheroes. Oh my. We'll meet them all today as we explore the pop culture of the paranormal. What's behind our perennial fascination with UFOs or with superheroes and superpowers? In this hour, a look at the mystical side of the paranormal. The story of how comic book genius Alan Moore became a ceremonial magician. And investigative journalist Leslie Kane draws back the curtain on decades of unexplained UFO occurrences. But first, the legendary science fiction author Philip K. Dick. He has legions of fans, including one you might not expect. Novelist Jonathan Lethem counts Philip K. Dick as one of his literary heroes. Lethem is the editor of the Library of America's editions of Dick's novels, and he's the co-editor of a volume called The Exegesis of Philip K. Dick. It's based on the bizarre collection of thousands of pages of typed and handwritten notes, journal entries, letters, and story sketches that Dick obsessed over during the last 8 years of his life. He was trying to come to terms with a series of strange visionary experiences. Jonathan Lethem tells Steve Paulson about the events that changed Dick's life.
It's so easy to ask and it's so hard to say because, of course, saying what happened to him is what the whole project of the exegesis consists of. What we're certain happened is that he began to experience an almost overwhelming sense of revelation. Visions occurred to him and concepts occurred to him. Voices came to him. Dreams that weren't like regular dreams happened to him at night, and he ascribed all of this to some kind of higher power. And he didn't know what it was, but he felt contacted by something, and he began to try to interpret it.
And it goes back originally, apparently, to a visit to the dentist when he had his wisdom teeth removed.
He'd been to the dentist, and he needed a painkiller, and the pharmacist sent a delivery person to his door. And he opened the door, and the delivery person was a young woman who was wearing a Christian fish, you know, that symbol that we see on the backs of bumpers of cars now. And she was wearing it around her neck, and he was struck, not just by curiosity, but he felt some kind of awesome flood of information entering his body and his brain at that moment. And he asked her what it was, and she said it was a symbol of ancient Christianity. So that seemed to him a very important clue. And from that point on, and for the next couple of months especially, although the visions were intermittent for the rest of his life, he was recipient of a flood of unsettling, revelatory feelings and thoughts.
And to the point where, I mean, in this particular case, apparently he thought that he and this young woman who delivered the painkiller were secret Christians from way back when. I mean, there was sort of this sense of, I don't know if reincarnation is the right word, but there was a long history that went back there.
That was one of the thoughts he had, and he became obsessed with historical interpretations, theological interpretations, philosophical concepts. At one point, he thought he was being taken over by the ghost, essentially, of a dead friend of his, Bishop Pike, who had been a very important figure in the Bay Area religious scene a few years before and had died in mysterious circumstances in the desert in Israel. He believed for a while that this was evidence that the entire universe was a computer, and he generated a lot of notions and theories that actually recapitulate a lot of some of the most far-out speculations of contemporary philosophy and physics. He basically grappled with this revelation with every tool available to him, from Encyclopedia Britannica to going to see Nicholas Roeg's film The Man Who Fell to Earth with David Bowie in it, and suddenly imagining that an alien race had contacted him. He'd use anything at hand, basically, to try to adjust and interpret and expand his guess about what kind of mystical vision he was undergoing.
Now, it would be tempting to write off these episodes as psychotic in some way, and maybe drug-induced, you know, after he originally had his wisdom teeth extracted. I don't know, but that seems too simple.
Well, it's almost impossible not to want to write them off or explain them away in some form. I sort of joke in the introduction that anyone looking for a description other than revelation will be spoiled for choice. You can guess that he was experiencing some kind of series of small strokes. You can guess that he was undergoing a very specific kind of neurological disorder called temporal lobe epilepsy. You can guess about drugs you can guess about, paranoia you can guess about, schizophrenia you can decide he was just a science fiction writer who'd taken his own visions too seriously. And I think that what's worth saying is that all of these things are theories he himself would have been interested in. And he generates his own guesses about psychosis in the pages of the exegesis. It wasn't that he insisted that there was a divine explanation or that he was somehow suddenly in an exclusive conversation with a higher power. It's that he was experiencing an intricate and extensive series of philosophical thoughts as a result, and he thought it was worth trying to understand them on some term or another. So he himself is very open to some of the exact explanations that others would use to dismiss what was going on. And the reason it's impossible to dismiss the exegesis is not because there could ever be any evidence that something other than one of these explanations was the cause of it. Forget the cause. The pages themselves exist. He wrote in this vein brilliantly for 8 years of his life.
And this is what we have now. I mean, this book that you have edited. And it's worth pointing out that The Exegesis of Philip K. Dick is an enormous book. It's, what, 900 pages long or something like that?
Well, it's 900 pages long and it's a fragment.
Right. What he actually wrote over those 8 years was much longer than that.
Between 8,000 and 9,000 pages of manuscript were left behind. None of them published. A tiny fragment of them snuck into one or another of his novels. But basically, he left behind a trove of philosophical and theological speculation. Not all of it worth reading, not all of it coherent, but quite a lot of it intoxicatingly strange and brilliant. And it demands to be encountered. It doesn't really matter where it came from. And so looking for the external explanation stops being interesting once you start to delve into the pages themselves and see how compelling and strange and self-reflexive they are. They're basically a very brilliant mind going mano a mano with the universe.
I love your description of the exegesis. I mean, you say it's absolutely stultifying, it's brilliant, it's repetitive, it's contradictory, it just might contain the secret of the universe.
Yeah, well, that's a sort of a tease. The problem with looking to it for an answer is not that it doesn't contain one. It's that it doesn't contain one. It contains 1,000. He contradicts himself again and again. He throws everything out and goes back to the drawing board and generates another theory about how time and space and mind interact and why we're here and what the universe consists of. So it's useless as a compass. It won't lead you to anything in the way of a solution to the matter of existence, but it will, if you do give yourself to these pages, it will give you an immense experience of how perplexing, how rich, how extraordinary the dilemma of existence really is.
So do you have favorite passages or parts of the exegesis?
I have loads, yeah. It switches gears a lot. You know, he was a very complicated, contradictory, very seductive and brilliant mind. He was famous for taking people on strange journeys. If they'd come and visit him, he'd tell them what they wanted to hear, and he'd do it for hours on end. He was a Rorschach blot of a mind. The exegesis itself, sometimes it comes on very punitive and moralistic, like a kind of a nightmarish vision of God's requirements, and other times it's very polymorphous and inviting and strange and charming, and there are times when he despairs of ever understanding what his purpose on earth might be, and there are times when he becomes quite fascinated with his own writing, and he decides the answer might lie in his earlier novel. So if you're interested in his writing, you can find pages upon pages of him deciding all of a sudden that a book he wrote in 1964 is the answer to everything, that he accidentally already knew how everything worked in Ubik or The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch. I like a lot of it, and I like a lot of it in different ways. There are times, not a great number of them, where he switches into his storytelling mode, and he starts to be the writer you're familiar with from his novels, writing brilliant allegories or brief fables, essentially.
You have a copy of The Exegesis of Philip K. Dick there with you, and I guess I'm going to ask you to pick out something, and you have 900 pages to choose from, but a short passage that you'd like to share with us?
Okay, this is a nice bit to read. So in this sequence, he's talking about one of the most important names he's given to the spirit that seems to be reaching out to him from afar, from across history or from another dimension. And he's called it Zebra, and he's named it Zebra for its capacity to hide itself within our reality, for the stripes on its body that mean that unless you're looking very closely, it becomes invisible and just is taken as a natural part of our universe. But in fact, it's a enormously energetic spirit from afar.
Okay.
Paul Williams visited today, and I told him about zebra. I'm beginning to see in my mind's eye zebra itself, an actual animal, a striped horse. Shy and merry and mischievous, half hiding in the forest at the far edge, the sun shining, and zebra playfully advancing, and then just when you think he's going to emerge fully and separate himself from the trees, suddenly and unexpectedly he retreats and absolutely vanishes. You can't coax him out or lure him. You can't get your hands on him. His white is the dazzle of the sun, his dark stripe the shadows in the glade and forest, where amid the shadowy green the little things of the forest live unseen. Ah, zebra, why really did I choose that name for you? You mythical, lovely beast of sun and safe shadow. I saw you once, but can never, as if you are some fabled deity, prove to anyone that you exist. I inform them. I try to take you along with me to the special spot from which I saw you, and you're not there. But I sense the glint in your eye and your smile of understanding amusement. Are you the joy god Dionysus of root and star, of dark forest and the melting butter gold of the sun? What a psychological symbol Jung would have known you to be, playful and unpredictable, shy, pawing the ground with sharp hooves, goat hooves. Oh, goat god Dionysus, I recognize you. You are too wise, too experienced with our dangerous race ever to expose yourself to harm at our hands. We would kill and freeze you into stasis, hypostasis, and all your pawing and advancing and disappearing and smile, light would become dead glass, warm butter only hide, dead, frozen. But this is only your exoskeleton. Inside this form which I glimpse, you are motion and rapid change. Electrons? Sheer bioplasmic energy? I love you, I want to grip you, but you are elusive. But I am not disappointed. You are all the lovely passing persons, things and events I would want to freeze, to stop dead. Thank God I can't, zebra. My clutching, hugging, yearning embrace would kill you. My needs kill. My fingers are the claws of the petrified dead, yearning to hold your life. Better this petrified fossil that I am should stay dead, that so you can live on in immortality. Thank you. Thank you for hiding from me. Thank you for your wise caution and your secret smile.
Wow.
It's intense. Yeah.
You just sort of go along and enjoy the ride.
It's very much a book for surrendering yourself to, browsing in, seeing what interests you. It's so multifaceted that any single excerpt is destined to be misleading, because there are other places where it takes on the tone of a very, very scholarly, objective kind of crypto-scientific analysis of the nature of the universe. And so these parts of Dick, the lyrical, the allegorical, the expressive, are in a dialogue with this incredibly powerful urgency about knowing, about learning something. And the book is very much an attempt to create a scholarship for something unprecedented. He's trying to find language to encircle insights that are unknown in philosophy or theology. They're unprecedented.
So how do you try to make sense of these visions? I mean, do you just sort of, I don't know, see it as a literary endeavor? Or do you try to look for the metaphysical reality underneath?
I'm a strange candidate in some ways for talking or thinking about this stuff at all, because I'm very disinclined. I've always been very disinclined to any kind of mystical explanation for the mysteries of existence. I tend to root my search personally in the manifest world, in literature and the arts and the humanities, I guess would be the word for it. And so it was only my interest in Dick that led me to have any curiosity about the exegesis whatsoever. If I'd had it paraphrased for me, I don't think I would have had any leanings that way. But once you encounter it in his hands, you realize this is an investigation of consciousness through language. And that's what every writer ultimately realizes they're engaged in. And it's a very mysterious area, and it involves allegory and metaphor. One of the strange things about the exegesis is it becomes a book about its own process. It's a book about writing, because one of the strangest occurrences, forget the visions, one of the strangest occurrences in Dick's life is the compulsion to make this kind of exploration in language, to write it all down and try to understand it and to accumulate all these apparently useless pages. I mean, he was a novelist who was doing something completely irrelevant to his public career. He was journeying into kind of a strange engagement, and the exegesis marvels at its own properties, and he begins reading it and trying to contemplate what it could be that would compel him to write such a thing.
Jonathan Lethem is the co-editor, along with Pamela Jackson, of the Exegesis of Philip K. Dick. He spoke with Steve Paulson. If you have questions or comments about the show, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, we'll explore how the paranormal manifests itself in comic books as we continue our Hour on the Paranormal Pop Culture. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Jeffrey Kripal is the author of Mutants and Mystics, science fiction, superhero comics, and the paranormal. He's also a professor of philosophy and religious thought at Rice University. As he tells Steve Paulson, Kripal traces the origin of his new book to something very strange that happened to him in 1989.
I was in Calcutta researching my dissertation. I was engaging in a ritual festival called Kali Puja. And one of the nights of the festival cycle, I woke up asleep. In other words, my mind came online, but my body was essentially paralyzed. And while I was lying there, this very, very intense energy entered me. Of course, it might have been in me all along, and sort of took me over in some sense until it became so intense that I had a sensation of leaving the body. I got back into my body and woke up in control of my body again now and had this sort of profound sense that I had been zapped, I had been radiated, something had been downloaded into me. All these metaphors capture something of it. They all fail. But it was a quite extraordinary experience. It wasn't like a dream. It wasn't metaphorical. It was very, very physical. And it had profound effects, actually, on the way I thought, particularly how I thought about religion. So that's really the ultimate origin of the book. That was in 1989, though. That was 22 years ago.
Yeah. Just to follow up on this particular experience, how do you explain what happened to you?
Well, I can't. I mean, there are different models here. There's a large literature on sleep paralysis. Clearly, the imagination, my imagination was involved in it. But ultimately, I'm still left with this sense of some kind of altered state of energy that rewrote me in some way and made me really, really interested in mystical literature really across the board. So ultimately, I decided I couldn't explain it, but that I could make some sense of it by studying mystical literature in different cultures and in different times.
So what is the connection then between mystical experience and these pop culture genres that we're all familiar with, science fiction and comics?
Well, there's all sorts of connections. First of all, just to kind of go back to that original experience, so many of the heroes or the protagonists of these stories receives his or her power through some sort of zapping or radiation or altered state of energy. So there's that. That's the obvious one. But also the artists and the authors whom I interviewed or read, they themselves explicitly invoke their own mystical experiences, which they often describe as paranormal. And so the book was really an attempt to sort of make sense of those experiences and relate them to artistic and literary creativity.
And you have isolated what you call seven myth themes. Can you briefly run through these?
Yeah, I suggest what I call the superstory with these seven myth themes. The first one is divinization and demonization. This is the traditional religious language where beings come from the sky and do various things to human beings, either positively or negatively. The second one, which really comes online in the 19th century, is orientation. And this is where Western culture starts to really look to the East or to some other far, far away land for its source of insight and magic. The three real main ones of the book, though, all appear in the 20th century, and they all involve science. The third one is alienation. This is the theme of the alien that kind of comes out of modern cosmology and space science. And, of course, Superman is the main example here. Superman is a crashed alien. And this really generates the comic, the superhero genre. So many of those early DC superheroes are essentially all aliens or have some relationship to that. The next mytheme is I call radiation. It goes back to Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the end of World War II, but it really doesn't come online till the 60s with Stan Lee and Jack Kirby at Marvel, where so many of their stories involve some form of radiation.
Of course, I think of Spider-Man there.
Spider-Man's the classic one, getting bit by the radioactive spider. And then the fifth one is mutation, this invocation of DNA and evolutionary biology to explain these transformations. These are all codes, of course. I'm not arguing that this is what cosmology or physics or evolutionary biology are really about, but these languages were all taken up by this genre. And then the final two, which really in some ways aren't technically mythemes, are realization and authorization. And this is simply the process by which a writer or a reader comes to understand that a paranormal experience is somehow authoring them. In the case of realization, or in the case of authorization, the artist or author is taking some control of that process and is now participating in the authoring of his or her own personal reality, as it were.
Well, I know this whole study that you've made of sort of the connection between science fiction, superhero comics, and the paranormal goes back to an earlier book that you wrote. You did a history of the Esalen Institute, the visionary community in Big Sur, California, that was founded by two Stanford grads, Michael Murphy and Richard Price. And they had their own theory of evolutionary mysticism. And you came to a conclusion that what they were talking about had some remarkable parallels to the X-Men comic series, right?
Right. Yeah, what happened was I was finishing that book in the summer of 06, and I was becoming obsessed with the comics of my adolescence, which was rather embarrassing, to be quite honest. So I started to ask myself, where does this obsession come from? And I realized at some point that the human potential movement, the basic idea of the movement is that psychical, mystical, paranormal experiences are essentially undeveloped buds of our evolving supernature, and that they point towards human nature in the future, maybe the far future. And I realized that that was as well the basic idea of the X-Men mythology. And not only that, but that Esalen was founded as a little community literally months before Jack Kirby and Stan Lee dreamed up the first X-Men issue. So there was something in the water, as it were, in 62, 63, in which the West Coast could create a mysticism based on this idea, and the East Coast could create a mythology based on this idea, and that they could kind of resonate between the two coasts. And that's really why I decided to write this book, is because I think this is where the human potential ideas have gone. They've gone into popular culture.
Now, another writer you mention in your book is Doug Minch, who wrote the Planet of the Apes comic book. And there's a bizarre story that he tells as he was writing one pivotal scene. Can you explain what happened?
He was writing a Planet of the Apes comic in the late 70s. He had just finished this scene in which this villainous ape named Brutus broke into the human hero's home with a mask over his head and took the human hero's wife by the neck and put a gun to her head. And he just had finished this scene, and his wife called his name from the other side of the house. He went to see what she wanted. He thought maybe there was something wrong. He entered the room, and there was a man in a black mask holding a gun to his wife's head, exactly as he had just written out in his comic writing. So there was this immediate hit between the writing and reality that's actually, believe it or not uncommon at all, particularly among writers who will write something and then watch it play out in reality. And so what Doug thinks about that is that he had either had some kind of unconscious precognition that then translates into his fantasy life, you know, or weirder yet, that he had somehow written reality before it happened. He couldn't write for months, by the way.
Wow. Did this affect his art later on, that experience?
Well, I think it was one of many events in Doug's life that impacted his writing. If you read his writing, he returns constantly to these these themes of human wild talents and extraordinary powers that lay dormant in us but can be accessed in different ways.
You know, I'm struck by these various stories you're telling, I mean, with some rather important figures in terms of those cultural figures who created these stories that are now show up on the big screen in Hollywood. And yet, I think the vast majority of people don't really know this history that you're talking about.
No, they don't. Why, I don't know. I mean, one of the things I point out in the book is for some reason we can't seem as a culture to talk about these stories in a balanced way. We either want to believe everything about them literally or we want to dismiss them as silly or fraudulent. We seem unable to sort of hold the middle ground and appreciate them as, yes, imaginative experiences, but imaginative experiences that appear to be filtering or translating something very, very real and profound. So yeah, I would say most people are completely unaware of this, but it's there, and a lot of the artists and authors have written about it extensively.
You say that we still lack a story big enough for the soul. So I'm curious, how do we create a story that is that big?
Well, I think we begin by treating people who report these kinds of experiences with a lot more compassion and sympathy and a lot less shame and humiliation. And I think we also have to be more humble about what we actually know about consciousness, what we actually know about the mind, which at the end of the day is not much. I mean, we know a great deal about the brain. We know a great deal about the neuroscience of awareness or consciousness. But we really don't know what consciousness is. And the history of religion, at least, is just filled with all of these clues, all of these signs that it may be vastly more grand than we keep assuming. And so I think what the fantasy writers are doing is they're laying the groundwork for what I call a soul-sized story, something big enough that can embrace the full human experience and not just these little slivers of it.
Jeffrey Kripal is the author of Mutants and Mystics, science fiction, superhero comics, and the paranormal. He's also the chair of the Department of Religious Studies at Rice University. He spoke with Steve Paulson. When you're talking about the intersection of science fiction and mysticism, or pop culture and the paranormal, there's one writer who comes to mind instantly. Alan Moore, one of the most influential creative forces in the history of comic books. Moore is responsible for groundbreaking series like Watchmen and The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. He's also a practicing ceremonial magician and a legendary recluse. But he does spend time every year with a fellow comic book creator, Gary Spencer Millage. Millage has just written a biography called Alan Moore Storyteller. He talks with Ann Strainchamps about his friend's work, beginning with a comic book series, V for Vendetta.
That was based on a very early idea Alan had about an anarchist vigilante that wore a mask, a very anti-establishment hero, but with a certain ambiguity. But Alan wove this incredibly intricate story around this almost Zorro-like figure that was set in the near future, or at the time of writing, the far distant future of 1995, I think it was. Mm-hmm. With David Lloyd on artwork, it just made a huge impact.
And this was in the early 80s, right?
Yeah, about 86, I think, 86, 87, it was serialised in Warrior originally.
Yeah. So Margaret Thatcher was in power in Britain. The British economy was in the doldrums. Did Moore have a particular political agenda, political philosophy he was working out through V for Vendetta?
I'm sure he was. With his upbringing, he was almost programmed to vote Labour. You know, there was a lot of anti-Thatcherite feeling at the time. The police state, which is very obvious in V for Vendetta, was obviously an extrapolation of what was going on at the time with video surveillance cameras on every street corner, which was something that, you know, you couldn't conceive back in the mid-80s, but of course it's very commonplace today.
Good evening, London. It's 9 o'clock and this is the voice of fate, broadcasting on 275 and 285 in the medium wave. It is the 5th of the 11th, 1997. The people of London are advised that the Brixton and Streatham areas are quarantine zones as of today. It is suggested that these areas be avoided for reasons of health and safety. Police raided 17 homes in the Birmingham area earlier this morning, uncovering what is believed to be a major terrorist ring. 20 people, 8 of them women, are currently in detention awaiting trial. Queen Zara today appeared at the opening of a new waste reclamation plant in Plaistow. This was the Queen's first public appearance since her 16th birthday in June. The Queen was wearing a suit of peach silk, created specially for the occasion by the Royal Couturier.
Alan Moore's most famous work has to be Watchmen. It's the only graphic novel actually ever to appear on Time magazine's list of the all-time 100 greatest novels. Can you give us a brief outline of the plot and what's Watchmen about?
Watchmen's about the potential end of the world, and it's a breakdown of superheroes.
What he's basically doing is kind of deconstructing the whole superhero genre?
Yes, and it's not so much the actual plot, but it's typical of Alan's writing approach, the symmetry in the book. It was produced originally as a 12-issue miniseries, and the first and the last issues bookended each other perfectly. Each page was broken down into 9 panels. It was very structural, incredibly well thought through, and it told a story in so many new ways and with such high quality in both the writing and the artwork. Again, Dave Gibbons was the artist on Watchmen. It worked on so many different levels that it became hugely popular by the superhero fan, and also people that, you know, maybe superheroes were a bit passé for them, they'd grown out superheroes a little bit. This was a completely different take on superheroes, so it worked for them as well.
Rorschach's Journal, October 12th, 1985. Dog carcass in alley this morning. Tire tread on burst stomach. This city is afraid of me. I have seen its true face. Streets are extended gutters, and the gutters are full of blood, and when the drains finally scab over, all the vermin will drown. The accumulated filth of all their sex and murder will foam up about their waist, and all the whores and politicians will look up and shout, "Save us!" And I'll look down and whisper, "No."
Kind of a grown-up take on superheroes? I mean, what do his superheroes do?
Watchmen almost became the basis for all superhero comics from that point onwards. I know Alan kind of regrets almost writing Watchmen because it changed them for the worse, because Watchmen was supposed to be the last word on superheroes, not the first word of a whole new kind of darker, grittier, kind of more violent sort of superhero, because Alan thought he was taking it to the logical extreme. People have kind of taken it on from there, and as I say, Alan probably regrets some of that now.
Alan Moore famously kind of reinvented himself around age 40 when he decided to become a ceremonial magician. Can you explain, first of all, what that even means?
Well, I'm not sure Alan really knew what it meant, whether you believe him or not. He actually said it was originally possibly a little bit of a joke that he had to carry through on, but I mean, his good friend Steve Moore, which he's been friends with since he was about 15 years old, was already experimenting in magic, and he had his first magic experience with Steve, conjuring up a demon. So he wanted to take it more seriously. I mean, at the time he was writing From Hell, which was a 600-page graphic novel that he wrote with Eddie Campbell illustrating. And there's a single panel in that where one of the characters said that if gods and demons exist in your mind, then they are real if they exist in your mind. I can't remember the exact quote. He said it was a panel that actually changed his life, changed his way of looking at reality and magic. Yeah, I mean, he claims to have regular, or have had regular, magic rituals to conjure up demons and make sacrifices by destroying something of personal value to himself, and worshipping a snake god called Glycon, which was actually a second century glove puppet some con man used to use. He said, you know, at least he's not going to believe that it created the universe or anything dangerous like that.
Wait. So is it a god or a puppet?
Well, it's a puppet that Alan uses as a god.
And does he think it's literally real, or does he think it's a figment of his imagination?
Well, I think reality and imagination are probably, you know, up for argument themselves. Looking from Alan's point of view, he knows Glycon is not literally real, but he's still chosen to have him as his god.
Does he have conversations with Glycon?
Yes.
And what sort of things does Glycon say?
Well, I haven't been there. I haven't been there personally.
Well, has Alan reported?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's kind of personal, the things that he's discussed with him, but it's helped him open his mind to be more creative. And I think the whole exercise is about expanding your mind and blurring the mind between fantasy and reality.
So he's got this famous phrase, art is magic, magic is art. What does he mean by that?
He means magic is creating something out of nothing. And when you write a story or draw a picture, I mean, you are literally doing that. You're actually creating something that didn't exist before. It could be an idea or a song or a piece of artwork. And that's what magic is in its most simple sense.
But there's got to be more to it than that. Because isn't he trying to turn that into a ceremony of sorts? To turn art-making into a form of mysticism?
From what he's told me, he doesn't do so many ceremonies now because he doesn't need to do them. But I think at the time, for a number of years, he did practice magic on a regular basis on his own and with a group of friends. And I think they did help create new art. The Birth Call, which was a performance piece that he wrote and later came out on CD and was later adapted into like a comic strip by Eddie Campbell. That was straight out of a magic ritual.
Inside the birth call is... The birth call is the honest silence of ourselves. We breathe in water that is warm and luminous and only are. The birth call is a monstrous bivouac of the impending soul upon the cold plateaus that overlook the world. The birth call is the street plan of Atlantis, hushed, drowned avenues of our beginnings, lost in myth and bladder rack.
There is some confusion as to what magic actually is. I think that this can be cleared up if you just look at the very earliest descriptions of magic. Magic, in its earliest form, is often referred to as the art. I believe that this is completely literal. I believe that magic is art, and that art, whether that be writing, music, sculpture, or any other form, is literally magic. Art is, like magic, the science of manipulating symbols, words or images, to achieve changes in consciousness. The very language of magic seems to be talking as much about writing or art as it is about supernatural events. A grimoire, for example, the Book of Spells, is simply a fancy way of saying grammar. Indeed, to cast a spell is simply to spell, to manipulate words, to change people's consciousness. And I believe that this is why an artist or writer is the closest thing in the contemporary world that you are likely to see to a shaman.
That's Alan Moore from a documentary called The Mindscape of Alan Moore. Gary Spencer Millage is a comic book creator and the author of Alan Moore's Storyteller. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. Are you an Alan Moore fan? If so, what's your favorite work of his? You can let us know by sending email through our website at ttbook.org, or you can connect with us on Facebook. There's a link to our Facebook page on our website. Coming up, we'll take a look at the enduring mystery of the UFO phenomenon as we conclude our hour on paranormal pop culture. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Leslie Kane is the author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. And, yes, there have been enough books written about UFOs to fill an entire section in a large bookstore. But this one is endorsed by theoretical physicist Michio Kaku, who says it's bound to set the gold standard for UFO research. As Kane writes, 95% of all reported UFO sightings can be explained as ordinary phenomena. But the remaining 5% includes UFO events that have been well documented and officially investigated. How did Leslie Kane become interested in UFOs?
I'm an investigative journalist by training, and I was working at a public radio station, actually a Pacifica station, in the San Francisco Bay Area back in 1999 as a producer and co-host of a radio show. And a colleague from France sent me an extraordinary report on the UFO subject that had been translated into English and was written by a group of generals, an admiral, the former head of the Space Study Center, the National Space Study Center in France, which was the equivalent to our NASA here, and a group of scientists, very high-level people, and they'd taken a look at some of the most important UFO cases only dealing with official data. And in looking at the cases for which there was enough evidence that they could rule out any kind of conventional explanation, this group of very distinguished people came to the conclusion that the best, most logical, most rational, and most likely explanation for this group of cases was what they called the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And again, there aren't that many UFO sightings that we have enough data for to make that kind of an assumption, but they found that conclusion. And I, as a journalist, thought this was absolutely fascinating that high-level people are actually saying that there's a very good chance that we are being visited by extraterrestrial craft.
That really is astonishing when you think about it from America's perspective. That is not an attitude that is taken here at all.
Exactly. And the thing that ran through my mind was just what you said. I thought, what if four American generals and an American admiral and the former head of NASA had come out and made that statement? What would the reaction be in America? It would be a huge story, front page news. So here it was happening in France. And so that's why, as a journalist, I got very intrigued with that as a story initially. And I did a piece for the Boston Globe based on that French report. And ever since then, I've been digging into it and been absolutely fascinated by this very genuine mystery that we still have not solved.
As you've stuck with this story, you've done a fair amount of research and you've found some fascinating things. One of the eyewitness reports, an official investigation, I guess, was from a Belgian major general, Wilfried de Brouwer.
It began in the fall of 1989 in November with a couple of triangular objects that were kind of cruising over parts of Belgium, witnessed by hundreds of people, including 13 policemen from different locations. It was just sort of this massive sighting. And the interesting thing about that was that these objects kept returning to Belgium for about a year and a half. These very large, triangular, silent objects with three bright spotlights on each corner and a red light in the middle. That was sort of the standard way people describe them, that could take off at the blink of an eye without making a sound and could kind of drift almost like a boat on the water, kind of drift over very slowly. Major de Brouwer was actually a colonel at the time, and he was given the job by the Ministry of Defense in Belgium to investigate this, to try to figure out who these visitors were, because they were committing infractions of airspace rules. Nobody knew what these objects were, what they represented, why they were there. And so he was in charge of this, the whole Air Force investigation. He worked closely with a group of scientists who conducted lots of interviews and kept massive amounts of records of all the reports that they got. He sent up F-16s to try to get closer looks at the object, to learn more about them. And they never were able to solve the question of what these objects were.
Well, there must have been a lot of suggestions at the time. One can imagine that the suggestion would be that they were radar invisible aircraft from some other country, for instance, or that they were some other kind of natural phenomenon. Each of those must have been considered and rejected by General de Brouwer?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I think the leading argument was that this was some kind of an advanced U.S. or possibly Russian, you know, spy plane, that it was some kind of a stealth aircraft that was being tested, exotic technology from another country. I just don't think anybody thought it was a natural phenomenon. It was just seen too many times. It was clearly this thing with these lights on it. But what General de Brouwer did was he went to high levels of his colleagues within the United States government, and he went to other governments within the NATO alliance and asked, is this one of yours?
Of course, would they tell him the truth?
Well, he believes that they would, and other people have told me that they would. I mean, he was a colonel. And you have this very strange thing happening. And the thing is that NATO countries don't go sending strange technology over their partners without telling them about it. I mean, it just doesn't happen. That's what I've been told. General de Brouwer certainly believes that they would tell him the truth.
There are a number of other stories that you go into over the course of the book. Pilots, I gather, are more likely than anyone else to see UFOs and to report UFOs, which I imagine makes sense. They spend more time in the sky than anybody else.
They are probably one of the more likely people to see them. They are not the more likely people to report them, though, however, because the problem we have is that pilots are very nervous about reporting sightings, and in fact, they are discouraged from doing so by the FAA, which is really a problem. The FAA actually says in its manual for its employees that if a pilot, a crew member, sees anything anomalous, sees a UFO, they are not to report it to the FAA, but they are to take it to a civilian research group. And they say, even if this is a life-threatening situation, you can report it to the police, but you can't report it to the FAA, which is the body responsible for air safety in this country.
How do they explain that?
They really don't. It's a good question.
I suppose the easy answer that leaps to mind is that the FAA is afraid of ridicule.
Exactly. And the pilots are, too. The pilots are afraid of ridicule. I mean, that's why they don't report a lot of their sightings. And we know this because there is a former NASA scientist by the name of Dr. Richard Haynes, who has spent decades interviewing pilots. He's an aviation expert on these cases, and he has files of cases. And the pilots have talked to him, but they have not filed any kind of official reports on these sightings with the FAA for the reasons I just mentioned. Yeah. So there are a lot more pilots that see them than there are pilots who report them. And sometimes aviation people will report them to a civilian group just because they feel it's so important, especially when the situation involves safety issues. They just feel, well, this has got to be dealt with, so they have no choice. They go to a civilian group, and then the word gets out. It's a very strange situation, and this is not how it's handled in Europe.
Well, now, that's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because it is more likely to be reported elsewhere. In fact, you've got a couple of reports from military pilots who met for the first time when you were present and related what sound like remarkably similar stories.
Those were both Air Force pilot situations as opposed to commercial pilots. They both involve cases in which the pilots felt a need to fire, to actually aim missiles and try to shoot down a UFO. One of them was from Peru and one was from Iran.
Just to kind of summarize them, they both involved sightings and both involved fear of being attacked, and they responded by wanting to defend themselves.
Yeah, that was more the case for the Iranian event, which took place in 1976. The pilot in that case, there were four pilots involved that were sent up by the general on the ground to just observe what this brilliant light was that was sitting up there over Tehran, being witnessed by lots of people on the ground. And this pilot in this one aircraft, there was this very, very brilliant triangular-shaped object. And from that object, these smaller, what he called projectiles, these round things came, were sort of shot out towards his aircraft. He felt compelled to defend himself, prepared his firing system to fire heat-seeking missiles at these things. So he had it locked on so that the missile knew where to go, was just about to press the trigger to fire this thing, and he lost control of his equipment. And this happened three different times. He was just about to press the button and fire, and he would lose control of the equipment. That's something he could not explain, but that's what happened. And this case was written up in detail by the United States government, by the way, in a three-page Defense Intelligence Agency document, which is absolutely fascinating.
So I have to ask you then, do you believe that UFOs are evidence of extraterrestrial visitation?
Well, I certainly am open to that possibility. You know, I align myself with many high-level people who have themselves stated that they can't imagine what else these things could be. So we have something we call the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And yes, I definitely do believe that that needs to be seriously considered. I think it's a very likely possibility, even though I know it's very difficult to accept it, given the questions that physicists will raise about, you know, travel through space and all the issues that come along with considering this. And why haven't we already discovered it, if it's real, if they're really visitors? You know, there's lots of questions that come up, which are legitimate questions. Nonetheless, we're sort of stuck with the data that we have. There's nothing we can do about what we know. And it's very hard to come up with other explanations, but there's other explanations such as things like visitors from other dimensions or something. Yeah. You know, if you look at some of the cutting-edge physics, the work of Brian Greene or Michio Kaku, you know, these could be some kind of visitors from the future, from other dimensions, or from other planets. We just really don't know. But I think we have to stay very open to the possibility that they could be extraterrestrial. And that word, I guess, could have a lot of different meanings. I don't understand why everybody wouldn't want to know what these things are. Right. I think it's just the most fascinating mystery that we're faced with right now, one of the most fascinating anyway.
Leslie Kane is the author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Paranormal Pop Culture. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.